This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Mike Webster's 16-year National Football League career with the Pittsburgh Steelers and Kansas City Chiefs earned him Super Bowl rings, All-Pro selections, and respect amongst his peers. He was widely regarded as one of the best centers to ever play the game. But by the time he retired in 1990, the years of head-on collisions with other linemen had left Webster brain-damaged. For years before his death in 2002, his health had declined and his life had become chaotic. This week, Mike Webster's estate won a landmark case against the National Football League. Pending appeal, the league will now have to pay over $1.5 million in disability retroactive to 1991. The decision helps ease the pain of a long-suffering family and could open the door for many former pro football players still suffering from a variety of ailments after their retirements. Greg Garber is a senior writer for ESPN, and he recently chronicled Webster's story in a five-part series. He joins me now from Cheshire, Connecticut. Greg, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
How bad was Mike Webster's condition by the time he retired?
By the time he retired, he was clearly suffering the early stages of dementia. One of the difficult things that the estate had in trying to prove its case against the NFL was that there were no doctor's records and even evaluations at the time. In fact, it was such an accepted thing within the family that they really never sought medical attention until about 3 or 4 years later. And that was the real problem they had in proving their case against the NFL.
Can you briefly take us through Webster's life after football?
Yeah, he retired, and like most highly decorated fellows, he had some money in the bank, probably between $2 and $4 million. He fancied himself as a businessman. He sort of shuttled to projects in Philadelphia and Wisconsin and, of course, in Pittsburgh. Gradually what happened was the money disappeared. In about 2 years, it had sort of leaked away in bad real estate deals and so on and so forth. And at the same time, physically, his life was sort of declining as well. He was in great pain from numerous injuries. I mean, too many to almost count. Probably 16 or 17 different places on his body had sort of been compromised. And as time went on, he became addicted to a variety of painkillers and all sorts of narcotics that sort of eased the pain. At some point, he started using a taser gun. The only way he could really, you know, relieve the pain was to knock himself out.
Did the fact that few considered brain damage to be a byproduct of football when Mike Webster retired contribute to the league failing to recognize his disability when it should have?
Yes. You've got to remember the context here. It's like a discussion of steroids. You have to understand that at the time that Mike Webster played, in the 70s essentially, concussions were an unknown. In his career, Mike Webster was never diagnosed with a concussion. In retrospect, that seems almost absurd. Doctor's records, you know, suggest, you know, some trauma. He did not miss games. The only games he ever missed were after a dislocated elbow. So the bottom line is no one really knew the kind of cumulative damage that playing football could do. And in many cases, Mike Webster was sort of a worst-case scenario. He played center. He played at a time when helmets were basically thin plastic shells. He played more games. He played more downs in a very vulnerable position because he's snapping the ball through his legs. So if you add it up with the way his position was played, the way he played it, his iron constitution, all of those things worked against Mike Webster. And so he comes out of the NFL really approaching dementia.
How unusual is Mike Webster's story?
That's a matter of debate. Today, we understand concussions. Today, we have a better grip on things to the point that Troy Aikman and Steve Young and players like that have been forced to retire when in the 70s they would have played on for another 5 or 6 years and maybe, again, ended up as punch drunk as a Muhammad Ali or a Mike Webster. So that dynamic has changed. The technology has changed. The heads are protected far, far better than they used to be. And another thing, the money that has come into the league has changed players' careers. They don't play nearly as long as they used to. So in many cases, Mike Webster was a worst-case scenario. What's interesting to me is that the players from that era, who now are in their 50s, I talked to Harry Carson, who played for the Giants for many years, he suffers many of the things that Mike Webster suffered. He, too, is fuzzy on occasion. He, too, struggles to function in society. He, too, has had some go-rounds with the NFL. And it's these sort of dislocated players, these guys from the 70s who are now approaching, you know, their 60s, Social Security years, things like that, that's going to be the interesting group to watch when it comes to how the NFL deals with its retired players.
Do you feel that the publicizing of Mike Webster's case will alert more people within the league and beyond to this danger?
Yes, again, it's damage that's been done. There's nothing anyone can do about it at this point. That's the real interesting question is, will these people come forward? Will they seek retroactive disability? In the case of Webster, no one was really denying that there had been some damage done. The question was, you know, when did the clock start? And technically, you know, could they prove their case? And ultimately, that's what they did.
All right. You've talked about the question of whether more players will come forward or the families of more players will come forward. What about the possibility that the National Football League will become more proactive in recognizing symptoms among its retirees?
That's a fair question. I've had discussions with the players' union on that, and I do think that this is going to create a heightened sensibility. I think the league was nervous about this precedent. They were concerned that this would sort of, again, open up a can of corn that they weren't really ready to deal with. And now that it's happened, it's going to be, I think, incumbent on the NFL to sort of step up and deal with these things. There are hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in that pension fund. And the Webster family was asking for, I mean, essentially a drop in the bucket. They're talking about $1 million and change for again, damage done to their father, their ex-husband, et cetera. And it'll be interesting to see how the NFL reacts to this.
Greg Garber is a senior writer for ESPN.com. Greg, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, sir.
Six-time Tour de France winner Lance Armstrong chose this year's Tour de Georgia as the event at which to officially announce the end of his competitive cycling career. But what spectators at America's biggest pro cycling stage race may not have expected was the emergence of Armstrong's possible successor. Reporter Joe Silva has our story.
The third running of the Dodge Tour de Georgia would have probably slipped off the media radar if six-time Tour de France winner Lance Armstrong had not chosen the occasion to announce his long-rumored retirement.
I have to tell you that I'm 100% committed and the decision is final. Ultimately, athletes have to retire. I've been doing this for 14 years. I've been a professional athlete for almost 20 years. The body doesn't just keep going and going and going. So my time has come, and there are many, many other things that I need to do in life.
The news coincided with the announcement that former teammate American Tyler Hamilton would receive a 2-year suspension for resorting to the practice of blood doping to improve his performance. Both announcements shook the cycling community both here and abroad, but that didn't stop thousands of fans from lining the streets of Augusta, Georgia for the start of this race.
And ladies and gentlemen, Lance Armstrong!
Over the Tour de Georgia's 6 days, 16 participating teams logged some 650 miles before the race concluded just outside downtown Atlanta. The lead changed several times, and riders were treated to the best and the worst of Georgia's fickle spring climate. Josh Cadis represents the Kodak Sierra Nevada cycling team.
It was hailing on the guys for a while, pouring rain today in the Tour de Georgia, and you see guys drop out at the feed zone because it's an easy point to get to and say, okay, I've made it this far. There's a dry place for me to sit. There's a change of clothes. And, you know, let's just start thinking about the next race.
But the hail and inclement weather of that 134-mile stage from Dalton to the small town of Dahlonega wasn't enough to take the leader's jersey from American Floyd Landis.
Please welcome your Dodge Tour de Georgia leader, USA, Floyd Landis.
Landis, who rides for the Swiss team Phonak, had been one of this year's pre-race favorites. He began to cement his chances for an overall victory when he won the individual time trial on April 21st, an 18.6-mile race against the clock that constituted Stage 3 of the Tour. But as Lance Armstrong had predicted, the race would not be decided until the grueling fifth stage that concluded on top of Georgia's highest peak, Brasstown Bald. It was at that point that Landis surrendered his lead to Armstrong's well-prepared Discovery Channel team. Landis could do little to prevent Discovery's focused determination.
Clearly, the objective was to try to hold on to the lead. You know, it doesn't always work out and wasn't the ideal situation for me, and it was a very good situation for Discovery. They had a strong team, and their tactics were flawless, like usual. Johan Brunel's an exceptional director. So, yeah, I think we did everything right, and certainly did everything right, and they won.
Armstrong and the rest of his team worked hard to put young American Tom Danielson in the leader's jersey. Danielson won the race to the top of Brasstown Bald and was able to retain a narrow 9-second lead on Landis and an even narrower 4-second lead on Team Gerald Steiner's Levi Leipheimer during the following day's final stage to seal the overall victory. Danielson spoke about his win on Sunday.
I knew I was in good hands from the beginning of the day, and then the end was rather stressful for me, you know, just with the circuits, and the time was very, very close, 4 seconds and 9 seconds. So if anything were to happen, flat tire, crash, it would have been all over. So these guys are the best in the world, you know, so to have them looking after you is another incredible experience. It just wraps up an incredible week.
Discovery Channel is the only American-based team to take part in the newly established Pro Tour classification, a collection of elite squads designated by the International Cycling Union to compete for the sport's highest honors. And while six other Pro Tour teams were included in this year's Tour de Georgia, the race's reputation must continue to grow before more key European riders will begin to participate. Bobby Julich rides for the Danish team, CSC.
It definitely has to grow, but they've made some serious improvements from last year to this year, and it's made it very, very enjoyable for me and my teammates. And that's the most important thing, because that gets around the peloton. So when guys have an option to put this on their program, and they talk a little bit about it to the guys that did the race, and everyone comes back with great, you know, high accolades, it definitely helps.
But for Team Discovery's Tom Danielson, his 2005 Tour de Georgia win was big enough to convince many that he may one day be one of the American men to fill Armstrong's shoes. For Only a Game, I'm Joe Silva.
Congratulations to Tom Danielson.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Steroids are out for Major League Baseball players, so what's an elderly center fielder to do? For 40-year-old Steve Finley of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, the answer is a leather pouch full of mysterious elements. Finley wears the pouch around his neck and credits an amulet with keeping him healthy and productive at the plate. According to the company that makes the pouch, its contents are, quote, minerals combined to achieve alignment of body, mind, and spirit, and they are especially effective at addressing, quote, the electropollution, toxic vapors, scars, surgeries, and traumas to the skin by organizing the quantum nature of man. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, holding court with the Brat. But first...
Alert! You are entering the Pond of Norwood, Kid Zone. By entering this Kid Zone, you agree to the following. Kids are number one. Fun, not winning, is everything. Fans only cheer, and only coaches coach. No yelling in anger. Respect the volunteer referees. No swearing. Set a proper example for our children.
Jim Piatelli, the proprietor of The Pond, a hockey rink just off Route 1 in Norwood, Massachusetts, has the place posted with signs to eliminate any misunderstanding of how he runs The Pond.
Has anybody ever come in and read this sign and shrugged and walked back out the door?
No.
So nobody leaves, because it's no secret that hockey playing at The Pond and elsewhere is all about fun, right? And what parent doesn't repress whatever his or her competitive instincts might be in favor of fun for the kids? Unhappily, lots of parents, one of whom actually killed the father of another player 5 years ago in Reading, Massachusetts, and was convicted of manslaughter 2 years later. That incident was far too extreme to be representative, but according to Jim Piatelli, even at The Pond, a number of misguided adults somehow missed the message that fun is the point, which explains why he needs the signs.
I can't tell you how many parents come through this building that act worse than the kids do. I mean, just some of the stupid things that they do, kicking the doors, banging on the glass, swearing, you know, come on, Johnny, go faster. I mean, and I just shake my head.
On Wednesday evening at the pond, parents like that were nowhere in evidence. In the heated room separated from the ice by a plastic window, kids too little to learn even the non-Czech variety of hockey underway on the other side of the window watched a cartoon show on TV. Their moms chatted together and tried to figure out which of the tiny skaters in the droopy jerseys and oversized hockey helmets were their kids. Carol Thomas, the mother of 6-year-old Christian, described the attractions of an hour on this rink, which is about a third the size of a regulation hockey surface.
Well, it's a fun program. You know, the kids, this particular one, a lot of them all know each other, so it's a real, like, pick-up hockey type of thing. It's a great chance for kids of this age level to get involved in the play a lot. It's a lot different than the big ice surface where they have to do a lot of skating to get to the puck. Here they get to touch it a lot. They usually can score a lot more. It's really good for them to boost their confidence.
Well, sure, I say. Confidence is a good thing, but no Czech hockey? I ask Carol Thomas and her friends, Diane Stone, Cheryl Piatti, and Gina Cosmore, if their 6-, 7-, 8-, and 9-year-old kids, who've doubtless watched the big and bigger kids play, don't miss the opportunity to bang each other around.
My kids haven't yet.
I don't know. Mine either, no. Jake knows what checking is.
He doesn't. At practice, they're just taught, go for the puck, and that's truly, they come up thinking that's what you do. It doesn't cross their mind that they're not doing something the pros do. Or, I mean, they watch plenty of hockey, you know, certainly college hockey and every level. You know, they know, but they're fine doing it the way they're taught to do it.
The way they're taught to do it in the 3-on-3 games here means not only no checking, but no keeping score. In this undersized rink, it also means no offsides, so the play is pretty much continuous. One of Jim Piatelli's comrades in this enterprise is Steve Leach, who played for the Boston Bruins during the early and middle 90s. Despite the fact that none of the youngsters on the ice is dropping his gloves, Steve Leach liked Jim Piatelli's idea from the start.
It's just like pond hockey. It's skills. It's developing. I mean, if you see a lot of the guys that play now in the NHL after practice will go down and play 2-on-2, shinny hockey, you know, just two-pass, they call it, or just pond hockey. And that's really good for your handling the puck and feeling the puck and making plays and getting to an opening. And right here at the pond, it's wonderful.
The pond hockey comparison is valid except for one important detail. The 3-on-3 games here include an official. With no offsides, his primary responsibility is to drop the puck for face-offs. But when Carol Thomas's 6-year-old son Christian gets flattened behind the net, a check, inadvertent or not, the ref waves play to a stop and awards young Christian a penalty shot. He straightens his shoulders like a pro, begins his rush, and lifts the puck into a kind of gentle end-over-end arc that drops it just over the keeper's glove and into the goal. Precisely an hour after the 3-on-3 game began, it ended. Some of the kids were still energetic enough to begin chasing each other around the miniature turf soccer pitch on the other side of the building. The others clunked over to the benches beside the rink, where their moms and dads helped them get out of their hockey gear. An especially complicated task for Kevin Stone, one of the goalies. I asked him why he'd chosen a position that required so much padding and exposed him to shot after shot.
I just don't really like skating that much, but I do like playing hockey.
As a responsible reporter, I next moved down the row of half-dressed players to interview the star of the game. I asked Christian Thomas about his opportunity to skate in on the goalie unimpeded.
It felt good to get that shot.
Were you surprised when the referee skated over and said, "Penalty shot for you"? Did you know that you were going to get a penalty shot? How'd you know? What happened?
Since I got checked, I went up shorter, and that means shorter, you get a penalty shot.
Did you keep score out there, Christian?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I think it was like 18-17.
18-17. Okay. Did you guys win or lose?
I think we lost.
Since there is no official scorekeeper in these 3-on-3 games at the pond, nobody will ever know. But it looked to me like one of those games in which nobody lost. If these 6-, 7-, 8-, and 9-year-olds keep at it, somewhere down the line they'll learn to check and to take a check and to keep score. Nobody at the pond on Wednesday evening seemed to be in any hurry for that day to arrive. During his prime as a tennis player, John McEnroe was known as a winner and a whiner. He was such a powerful draw that tournament officials sometimes bent the regulations and bit their tongues to keep from penalizing McEnroe or tossing him off the court for his foul language, vulgar gestures, and other antic displays. In his new book, On Being John McEnroe, Tim Adams of The Observer analyzes McEnroe's impact on tennis and the culture beyond the game. Tim Adams joins me now from the BBC in London. Tim, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Hello.
What initially suggested to you that John McEnroe would be a good subject for a book?
Well, strangely, originally I was quite keen to write a book about the 1980s. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that McEnroe would do the job just as well, in a way, that all the things I wanted to say about the 1980s were really things I wanted to say about John McEnroe as well. So I was interested in the way that he kind of exemplified that era.
Early in the book, you quote McEnroe discussing a particular match that he played against Bjorn Borg at Wimbledon in 1980. McEnroe said of the fans, quote, "They just didn't want this match to end." And then he said, "The match itself didn't seem to want to end." Isn't that a wonderfully mystical perception for a tennis player?
It is. And there was certainly a sense. I remember watching it. I was about 14 years old at the time. And that particular match was, I don't know, certainly the best tennis match I've ever seen. And it did have that sense where these two great players had been sort of waiting to test themselves against each other for a long time. And they were almost, I don't know whether they're enjoying it, but they certainly didn't seem to want it to come to a conclusion. They were so close, both in sort of talent and in determination.
When John McEnroe played at Wimbledon, there was, you suggest, a real tension among commentators and fans between admiration on the one hand and disgust on the other. Or is disgust too strong a word in this context?
I think it was disgust. I mean, McEnroe, particularly in England, and particularly in tennis, which is a very kind of decorous sport in Britain, or it had been, and McEnroe was a real shock to the system. And nobody really here knew how to cope with him at all. I think we talk about a special relationship between Britain and America, but he sort of threatened that relationship, I think, for a while.
A one-man wrecking crew of international relations. John McEnroe was known to call an umpire, quote, "a disgrace to mankind," one of my favorite phrases that he used. He sometimes would get into shouting matches with the fans. How much of that sort of behavior was necessary to his game?
Well, my sense was, at least initially, that he couldn't control that it was entirely sort of something that took him over. I think later he probably, to summon some adrenaline, he used to try and sort of work himself up into those frenzies, which were always sort of terrifying to watch in some ways and oddly compelling. So I don't know, I think it was a bit of both, really. I think there's hardly ever been a sportsman who was so sort of enthralled to his own emotions, I would say, than McEnroe.
There's the tension of opposites evident elsewhere in your consideration of John McEnroe, I think. You write that, quote, "he desired above all to be his own man, but he also became the perfect vehicle for marketing Nike products to people who wanted to assume some part of his identity." Have I got that right?
I think that's right. I mean, I think there was this point, again, in the beginning of the 80s, where the sort of cult of the individual and the man against society was very strong. And it was very strong in corporate branding as well as in sort of sports, and I think Nike were obviously amongst the first to sort of exploit that trend and to see it as a way of selling tennis shoes and sports kit.
So he was the corporate man but presented as the anti-corporate man, the kind of anti-hero to be benefited from.
Exactly. And I think the new style of corporate man was the sort of rebel figure that it was no longer the sort of company man. It was somebody who broke the rules and played it to his own sort of standards. And McEnroe could hardly have been a better example of that trend.
In the cover photo for your book, McEnroe, racket in hand, is shouting, and above his head are the words, "I'm so disgusting, you shouldn't watch, everybody leave." Did you feel as you were researching this book that McEnroe was sometimes operating as kind of a caricature of himself?
I mean, yeah, he did become a caricature, but it was something that he resisted. I don't think he didn't sort of play up to that, I don't think, particularly. I think it just, he was such an extreme kind of personality, particularly at that opening stage of his career, and particularly when most other players were fairly well behaved. He was sort of something else, really. And then that particular quote he made at Queen's Club in Britain, which is this sort of bastion of sort of upper class England. And I don't know how, I mean, the spectators there sort of sipping their gin and tonics, I don't think they would have known what to make of that at all.
You make the point that there were a number of players who were kind of imitators. Jeff Tarango is one whom you mentioned, but none of them really quite could pull it off the way he could.
Well, I think that's true. I think a lot of people had the attitude, but not quite the talent. I mean, I think the unique thing about McEnroe was that, you know, most sportsmen, they have to stay calm, they have to stay focused. They talk a lot about being in the groove and so on. And McEnroe was the only sportsman I could think of when I was writing this that could actually step outside that and become this kind of wild figure, completely out of control, and then summon up some kind of concentration or even use that sort of wildness to make himself more focused. Other players tried to do that, but I don't think anyone really achieved that. Most people who sort of exploded on court then, you know, lost the match. But McEnroe invariably won the matches that he was most extreme in.
There has been a decline in the amount of interest paid to male tennis players in recent years. Maybe the sport needs somebody like John McEnroe again, though I hesitate to say so.
Well, maybe. I mean, I love watching Roger Federer at the moment, who's... you know, a similar kind of player to McEnroe, obviously without the tantrums. But I think what happened with McEnroe when he came into the sport was that it became focused on this idea of personality. And I suppose Jimmy Connors and Ilya Nastasi as well were around at the same time. And everyone talks about personalities, and the sport itself took second place to that. And I don't think it's really recovered from that fact.
Late in your book, you make the point that numbers of McEnroe's contemporaries had major life crises when they could no longer play at the top level. You mentioned Bjorn Borg and Boris Becker in that context. But of McEnroe, you say, quote, he has escaped his image, perhaps even his fate. What did you mean by that?
Well, I find one of the things that fascinated me about him was that of all sportsmen you could think of, you couldn't imagine him having a kind of settled retirement. The tennis seemed to mean so much to him that it seemed almost impossible to imagine him sort of having a different life outside it. But he's, of all those players, he's the one player who has actually sort of reinvented himself. You know, he had his art gallery, he does his commentary, he's even had his sort of strange attempts at talk shows and so on. But he does seem very, almost much happier now he's not playing than he was when he was playing, which is very rare in sportsmen. Sportsmen often go into a decline after they've sort of lost the thrill of being out there.
Tim Adams is the author of On Being John McEnroe, published by Crown. He joined me from the BBC in London. Tim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Only a Game. In last week's edition of the Only a Game newsletter, I wondered if any sport had been changed as dramatically by technology as tennis has been. 25 or 30 years ago, the wooden racket began disappearing. It has been replaced by a series of more and more wondrous alloys that have made the good players serve great and the great players serve unreturnable. I invited readers of the Only Game newsletter to suggest sports that had been similarly altered by technology. Probably not coincidentally, the email this week contained a lengthy essay by Doug Yerchi entitled, I Found the Problem in Tennis. Mr. Yerchi makes the case that the difficulty is not with today's high-tech rackets, but with yesterday's oversized court, which was developed for a game much slower than the one played today by Roger Federer and the sisters Williams. Sounds illogical, he writes, but a smaller court will result in more rallies. David Ludwig began his reply to my challenge by suggesting solitaire and wrote, "The games that I play on my computer are a far cry from the ones I used to deal out with a deck of plastic cards." Then he went on to detail the effect of the fiberglass pole on the sport of pole vaulting and the introduction of the carbon fiber pole after that. Nothing in tennis happened so suddenly or so dramatically as this transition, he wrote. Mike Cloutman, who hears the show on Vermont Public Radio, contended that, quote, the world of competitive cycling has seen enormous advances in the use of space-age materials, end quote, resulting in much faster times. He also pointed out that America's Cup sailing had benefited from the technology design teams now use to create more efficient boats, and mentioned the impact of parabolic-shaped skis. These, he wrote, have revolutionized ski racing and also enabled beginners to, quote, make nice round turns quite easily and earlier on their learning curve, while experts have speed with control and handling on far shorter skis than they had just a decade ago. Should you wish to become involved in this exchange of ideas, and if you're a pitcher who's ever been the victim of a ball whacked back through the box by a hitter with an aluminum bat, I should think that you might, visit our website, onlyagame.org, and sign up to receive our newsletter.
It all began in Houston, where they played the game indoors. They built a big dome stadium, but one of its flaws was the grass just wouldn't grow where the sun refused to shine, so they ripped it out and put in the artificial kind. They put in AstroTurf, AstroTurf. What have they done to old Mother Earth? I don't want nothing beneath my feet that a horse can't eat, so take it away.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, cabotcheese.com, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, Bicon.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Francis Scott Key bequeaths logical and melodic mayhem to generations of American sports fans. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NBA's second season is on the brink of sending some tall gentlemen to the golf course. What has delighted or discouraged you in the playoffs so far?
There hasn't been a lot to be delighted by except the fact that teams are scoring. The most remarkable thing, I think, so far is the performance of 953-year-old Reggie Miller and the Indiana Pacers, who really put a clubbing on the Celtics Thursday night, and Reggie Miller helped with a 33-point night. He is going to be able to shoot that off-the-pick jump shot when he's 96, assuming he isn't already.
The San Antonio Spurs were surprised by Denver on Sunday, leading many to wonder if the Nuggets could pull off a big upset, but the Spurs seem to have found themselves Wednesday, so is it all over for Denver?
I think Denver will get one more game, but I think that series is pretty much done, yeah.
What would be your dream matchup in the NBA Finals?
I don't like to watch the Spurs. I'm tired of hearing about what a wonderful testimony that all for all that's good and right about America the Spurs are. But in terms of horses for courses, I would have to say San Antonio and Miami.
Reports surfaced this week, Charlie, that Phil Jackson has met with the Lakers' Jerry Buss and with the Knicks' Isaiah Thomas. What's it going to take to lure Jackson out of his, I would assume, very comfortable retirement?
An appeal on a level of consciousness that you and I do not share, Bill. I don't know. I mean, it certainly can't be money. It can't be achievement. If he wants to go back and coach a team that you know, full of players that he's already excoriated in a book, I can't understand why he would do that. He seems to be moving on two fronts. He seems to be interested in the Knicks, too, and, of course, he does have history there with them as a player.
Well, your comment about the book would seem to indicate you think he would be a better fit in New York than in L.A.
If it was anybody but Phil Jackson, I'd say yes, but that assumes Phil Jackson is any other normal human being, which he is evidently not.
In hearings before the House Government Reform Committee this week, National Football League Commissioner Paul Tagliabue and Players Association Chief Gene Upshaw both maintained that pro football was handling and could handle the steroid problem without assistance from the federal government. You think the government has bought that argument?
No, but you have to give Tagliabue credit. You saw it there in his performance in front of the committee. And remember that he and Bud Selig essentially said the same thing. We can handle it ourselves. The difference between a guy who made his career as a high-powered Washington lawyer and a guy who made his career selling used cars.
On Tuesday evening, Alex Rodriguez of the New York Yankees hit three home runs in his first three at-bats, setting up the possibility that he might hit four or five during the game. He didn't do that, but he had a pretty fair night anyway.
It became the 11th player in history in Major League history to put up 10 RBIs in a game. It may be the breakthrough moment for him in New York.
Meanwhile, Barry Bonds was not inclined to give curious sports writers any idea at all of when he might play again. Are you surprised?
No, I'm not. I don't know how much of this is injury, how much of this is psychological, how much of this is on the advice of my attorneys. I do not recall.
The NHL is apparently in no hurry.
It's in the news!
Yeah, it's never out of the news. It doesn't even have to play. Anyway, the league is in no hurry to allow Todd Bertuzzi to return. Mr. Bertuzzi was suspended over a year ago for punching Steve Moore, who has not yet completely recovered from his broken neck and concussion. What happens here when all the mucking up in the corners is over?
I have no idea, because I don't know if a suspension counts if you're not playing games. the penalty for doing this is to miss games.
Right.
You're not missing any games.
And the other point is, what's the good of being reinstated in a league that doesn't play?
The NHL's absolute ability to publicize itself badly apparently is as precise as it ever was. Nobody's paying attention to the league, and the only time they hit a story is whether or not they're going to continue to suspend a guy who committed a murderous act during the middle of one of the games that they're not playing anymore.
In Oshkosh, Wisconsin this week, a woman who had been convicted of stealing $3,000 from labor union accounts was told by a judge that she could either spend 90 days in jail or give her Green Bay Packers season tickets to charity. Do we have an update on what she decided?
It was a tough call for Sharon Rosenthal, but she has determined that she will give her tickets to the Make-A-Wish Foundation rather than spend 90 days in the slammer. But it took her an awful long time to make that decision. I would imagine that fans of the Cleveland Browns or the Seattle Seahawks wouldn't take 3 days to decide whether or not they're going to go to jail or give up their tickets.
Does this remind anybody else of the great Jack Benny line when a robber stuck a gun into his back and said, your money or your life?
I'm thinking.
Fans of David Beckham can now walk a so-called Pilgrim's Trail that includes the hospital where David Beckham was born, the school he attended as a lad, and the field where he kicked a soccer ball around with his da. Do you suppose the tour might include his first meeting with Posh?
I would hope it would at least end at whatever nightclub that was. But one of the highlights is the Walthamstow Stadium, where David worked as a 10-pound-a-night glass collector mm-hmm. on Greyhound nights. Mm-hmm. Does that mean he went around picking up the empty pints, or he picked up glass on the track so that the little Greyhounds wouldn't cut their feet?
I have to assume it's the empty pints, but I'd have to research that
one. You can make more than 10 pounds a night, I would think, picking up the empty pints.
Finally, Charlie, residents of Pikesville, Maryland
Woo-hoo!
Were recently treated to a brand new cutting-edge hybrid sport, bison tennis. What do you think? Will it go over on the new ESPN Livestock Channel?
Well, the sad thing is, of course, the bison were all rounded up and slaughtered for buffalo burgers. But there was a wonderful wire photo that showed a bison that apparently won the match,
mm-hmm.
leaping over the net, which I thought was a little bit beyond your average bison.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game, and he's never buffaloed by our sports kicker questions. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
From home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, there seldom is heard a discouraging word. And the skies are not cloudy all day.
A week ago at the Quebec Coliseum in Quebec City, Canadian singer Caroline Marcille discovered what lots of singers preceding her have learned. You cannot take lightly the responsibility of singing the U.S. national anthem before a sporting event. As 7,166 fans eager to see a hockey game between the U.S. and Canadian national teams waited, Ms. Marcille forgot the words to the U.S. anthem, started again and forgot them again, left the ice to get a lyric sheet, and, having returned, slipped and fell. This unhappy adventure is reminiscent of other anthem-related embarrassments. For example, sprinter Carl Lewis's attempt before a 1993 Nets-Bulls game to expand his career to include singing.
And the Rockets! Red Bear!
Uh-oh. 10 years later, before a playoff game between the Dallas Mavericks and the Portland Trail Blazers, it was 13-year-old Natalie Gilbert's turn to assault the national anthem.
What so proudly we hailed at the stars like stars.
Natalie's misadventure with Sir Francis Scott Key's text gave Maurice Cheeks, then the coach for Portland, a chance at an assist.
Stars last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watch.
In that 2003 incident, Gilbert and Cheeks were joined by a fair number of fans. That, according to John Melman, is how anthem singing should always work.
They shouldn't be singing it by themselves. The 20,000 people that are standing around watching should be singing along with them.
Or at least drown them out.
Yeah, at least drown them out. That's exactly right. And it is an anthem. It's something that we all should be singing. It's not a performance piece. It's an anthem that all Americans should be singing. And that was the original intent of any kind of anthem like that.
That conviction led Dr. Melman and the National Association for Music Education to initiate the National Anthem Project last month. The aim of the project is to encourage Americans to learn the words of the anthem and to sing it as well, a goal John Melman does not regard as unrealistic.
First of all, it's not that complicated, and people often criticize and say the song is very difficult to sing and so forth, and my response is, well, that's why you have music teachers.
Dr. Melman then demonstrated that it was not all that difficult to remember even the words to the rarely sung third verse of the anthem.
And where is that band who so valiantly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country should leave us no more? Their blood is washed out, their foul steps pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the star-spangled banner and triumph shall wave where the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Nicely done, I'm sure, but is John Millman's performance representative? Could it ever be? This week I had the opportunity to visit with Renee Rancourt, who has been singing the national anthem before Boston Bruins games and various other events for over 35 years. I asked him if, in the beginning, he'd worried about forgetting the words.
No. I was very cocky, as most beginners are. And luckily, I did learn my lesson very quickly because I was thinking of, you know, superfluous things, and obviously I forgot the words.
It happened to you?
Yes. Once, very early in my career. And unfortunately, it did hit the Boston Globe the next day. Very, very embarrassing. But the writer said, Renee Rancourt dooby-dooed his way through the national anthem a la Frank Sinatra, never missing a note, and left the ice to a rousing ovation.
The song is only a minute long. Why are the words so hard for people to remember?
Well, when you're home by yourself, you're taking a shower or shoveling snow, it's much, much easier to sing. When you get out there, there are all kinds of distractions. You know, you're worried about your hair, you know, and is my tie on straight? So every time I sing, I've been doing it now for 35 years, and it's been like 1,500 times just for the Bruins alone. So I say it's like a little prayer before singing. I mean, you go over the words and you meditate because I don't care how secure you might feel. When you get out there, it's a different ball game.
Now, our senior producer, Gary Wallach, has a theory that one reason that people forget the words to the national anthem so frequently is that they are syntactically disconnected. It's not an easy sequence of
yes.
words to remember because it doesn't sort of follow logically
right.
one phrase from the next.
It's the most difficult thing. It's non sequiturs. I, last night, as a matter of fact, sang another national anthem. I sang the Australian national anthem. Would you like to hear a couple of words?
I would love it. I would very much love it.
Australians all, let us rejoice, for we are young and free. Now, it's unbelievable. And it ends like this. In joyful strains, then let us sing. Advance, Australia! Oh, what a ball.
Yeah, but I like that. No bombs, no blood, you know.
Well, actually, the most militaristic thing is the rockets' red glare.
But bombs bursting in air.
Oh, that's right, too. I guess you're right.
Yeah.
But it does. See, I like to have a positive attitude about that. I like to think that it gives me a chance to be patriotic.
Beyond forgetting the words, national anthem singers also have problems with either the low notes or the high notes or both. There
yes.
is a real yeah. range problem for this song.
Yeah. The way I look at it is it should be a duet. It should be sung by, say, two people. Let's pick Robert Goulet singing the beginning of it. Oh, say, can you see, very macho, by the dawn's. And then the high part could be sung by Tiny Tim. And the rocket's red glare, the bomb tiptoe through the tomb, etc.
I like the bomb tiptoeing better than the bomb bursting. That's kind of nice. I like that image.
You can start very comfortably, you know, in a comfortable range. Oh, oh, say, can you see by the... And then you get further and further into the... And the rocket's red! You know, you have to say, what am I...
And you have this terrible realization that it's coming, the note that you can't hit.
Yes. Oh, yes. The range of the song is so weird that you do have to have some vocal technique. However, if there's anything wrong with you at all that day, it will show up.
The national anthem will find you out.
It'll find you. I mean, I've experienced that many, many times. I just was not feeling well. I had a cold. I'll do it anyway, you know, that kind of thing. And that's when you are very happy that you did practice a lot. That has been my best friend because the technique has to be there whether you are or not.
There's another problem with the national anthem, with singing the national anthem, that we haven't discussed yet, and that is the acoustics in the places where you sing it. How long does it take to get used to hearing Oh Say Can You See echoing back when you're already on rockets and red glare?
Yeah, that's impossible. Thank goodness that at the Fleet Center there is no echo. But the worst place is Fenway Park. You start listening to that other guy. Oh, say, can you see? Yeah, and you start listening, you start waiting for the echo, and you're in big trouble.
Well, there's no echo in here, so maybe you could take us out with a portion of our anthem.
And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? O'er the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yay. Rene Rancourt sings the national anthem at Bruins home games and at many other events around New England. Rene, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from the BBC in London. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to check out photos of hockey players who've taken the checking out, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Rene Rancourt, who helps us go out on a patriotic note.
Doobie-doo.
I don't know about you, but I've always felt that Mr. Rancourt's version of the little-known eighth verse of the Star-Spangled Banner is the standard by which all others should be judged. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.